Last week, we began our new series of messages through the book of Judges, and we noted a three-part introduction to the book running from chapter 1, verse 1 to chapter 2, verse 5. I'll just give you a reminder because we're going to get our second of our third parts of this introduction today. The big outline was Yahweh's command and promise in chapter 1, verses 1 and 2, the response of Israel from chapter 1, 3 to 36, and then thirdly, Yahweh's evaluation in chapter 2, verses 1 through 5. Last week, we got as far as verse 21. In that middle section, the response of Israel, we actually have three subsections. First, Judah, which we looked at last week, and then Joseph from 22 to 29, and the other tribes in verses 30 and 36. It's those two sections of our outline that we're going to be addressing tonight. And then next week, Lord willing, we will deal with Yahweh's evaluation at the beginning of chapter 2. So we are continuing to read of the response of Israel to Yahweh's command. And we noted last week that the response of the tribe to Judah to his command was mostly positive. However, when we got to the end of that section, we noticed that they fell short in a few ways. Verse 19, but they could not drive out the inhabitants of the lowland because they had chariots of fire. Verse 21, but the children of Benjamin did not drive out the Jebusites who inhabited Jerusalem. And after that long positive discussion of Judah, those negative notes at the end really set the stage for more of what we're going to see in the future. And we shift now from the tribe of Judah to the tribe of Joseph. Verse 22, and the house of Joseph also went up against Bethel, and Yahweh was with them. Now, it's actually unusual to read of the house of Joseph, since Jacob's blessings on Joseph announced at the end of Genesis were actually made to his two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. We don't usually speak of a tribe of Joseph. We have the tribe of Ephraim and the tribe of Manasseh. So we understand the reference here, the house of Joseph, to those two tribes. And later in our section, we're going to see them distinguished. But initially, we're just looking at them together. And we're told that they went up against Bethel. Now, the name Bethel means house of God. It was the place where the patriarch Jacob had slept and had a great dream. We read in Genesis 28, 12 through 13, then he dreamed, and behold, a ladder was set up on the earth, and its top reached to heaven, and there the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. And behold, Yahweh stood above it and said, I am Yahweh, God of Abraham, your father, and the God of Isaac. The land on which you lie, I will give to you and your descendants. So Bethel was the place where the Lord God had renewed the covenant promises that he had initially made to Abraham, had renewed with Isaac, and now he was renewing with Jacob. And recognizing the significance of what he experienced, Jacob set up a stone pillar of remembrance at Bethel, and he changed the name of the town from Luz or Luz to Bethel, the house of God, because it's where he had encountered God in this great dream. And of course, we know from the New Testament in John chapter 1 that Jesus is that ladder that connects heaven and earth. And he said, you will see the Son of Man and the angels ascending and descending on him, just as was described about that ladder that Jacob saw in his vision. Now, in the time of Judges 1, it was left to the house of Joseph to drive out non-Israelites from Bethel. Verse 22 tells us that they went up against the city and that Yahweh was with them. However, as we have noted before, Yahweh's presence and blessing did not relieve the house of Joseph of their responsibilities in the battle. Remember, the motto of Joshua and Judges is not let go and let God. It's trust in God, be obedient to him, and he will provide the victory. So we read in verses 23 and 24, so the house of Joseph sent men to spy out Bethel. And here we're told the name of the city was formerly Luz. And when the spies saw a man coming out of the city, they said to him, please show us the entrance to the city, and we will show you mercy. So the strategy they employ at Bethel is the same strategy they had earlier employed at Jericho. Spies are sent in, and they're able to get assistance from someone in the city so that they can successfully attack the city. In this case, they encounter a man leaving the city, and they say to him, "Please show us the entrance to the city, and we will show you mercy." Now, they're not asking, where's the main gate into town? Everybody would know that. But these cities would often have secret entrances, most likely tunnels, that would not be known. And so they're asking this man, show us one of those entrances. And if you do, we'll show mercy to you. In verse 25, so he showed them the entrance to the city, and they struck the city with the edge of the sword, but they let the man and all his family go. Perhaps because at this time he was aware of the fearsome reputation of the Israelite soldiers, the man agrees to cooperate. He provides the information requested, and that allows the Israelites successfully to attack the city with the edge of the sword. But as was the case with Rahab and her family at Jericho, this man and his family are spared in the attack. But whereas Rahab's family was assimilated into Israel, and we know she even finds a place in the genealogy of Jesus, that is not what happens to this man. Verse 26, and the man went to the land of the Hittites, built a city, and called its name Luz, which is its name to this day. And so this man does not stay in the promised land. He does not assimilate into the house of Joseph. Rather, he and his family move to the land of the Hittites. Now, we know from verse 23 that the town had originally been called Luz before Jacob had renamed it Bethel. And it seems surely to be significant that when the man spared builds a city among the Hittites, he called its name Luz. And I think that's probably more than just nostalgia for the old days. It would seem that he is exporting Canaanite culture to carry it on elsewhere. And that just is a reminder to us of why it was that Yahweh commanded that the inhabitants of the land be driven out, because their ongoing presence in the land would lead to spiritual compromise among the Israelites. And in this case, the land was cleansed, the city was taken, and the man who escaped was driven from the land. But what did he do? Most likely, he carried his false religion elsewhere. But at least in Bethel, that influence was taken away at that time. But as was the case with Judah earlier in the chapter, the initial positive report of the house of Joseph is followed by reports of failure. And first we read of the tribe of Ephraim. Remember, the house of Joseph has the tribe of Ephraim. And we first read of Manasseh. They have the tribe of Manasseh and the tribe of Ephraim. Verse 27, however, Manasseh did not drive out the inhabitants of Beth Shean and its villages, or Taanach and its villages, or the inhabitants of Dor and its villages, or the inhabitants of Ibleam and its villages, or the inhabitants of Megiddo and its villages, for the Canaanites were determined to dwell in the land. So after the positive news of the previous verses, the opening word of verse 27, however, has an ominous tone, right? We've just reported this great success at Bethel, and then, however. And as was the case with Judah earlier, the initial positive report of the on the house of Joseph is followed by reports of failure. And it's interesting that the positive is attributed to the house of Joseph, while the negative is attributed to the two tribes of Manasseh and Ephraim. I'm not sure why that is. Maybe it's they don't want to associate the name of Joseph with this failure. But in any case, we first of all hear about Manasseh. And what we have in our text, as you heard, is a list of places from which Manasseh did not drive out the inhabitants. And commentator Ralph Davis writes that this is an exercise in theological geography. And that's because Manasseh's failure to take these towns would come back to trouble Israel. David writes, without doubt, there were pragmatic reasons why Israel needed absolute control over many of these sites. Somewhere along the line, they would likely see the strategic folly of failing to possess Beth Shan, a massive site guarding the juncture of Jordan and the Jordan and Jezreel valleys, through which passed the main arteries of the ancient world. They would live to regret the failure to dominate Taanach, Ibleam, and Megiddo, crucial fortresses along the plain of Esdraelon. Maybe they could have prevented cocky Sisera from strutting all over Israel. We could also point out how strategic Gezer, we'll get to that in verse 29, was, but no more of this, for we are getting away from our author's concern. What he's saying is the author is not primarily concerned with what fortresses were associated with this place. Davis continues, the motivation for driving out Canaanites was not pragmatic, but spiritual. And this, again, we get to the point we just made. Yahweh had warned through Moses, do not let these people live in your country. If you do, they will make you sin against me. If you worship their gods, it will be a fatal trap for you. That's back in Exodus 12, 33. Remaining Canaanites would not be so much a military threat as a spiritual cancer. That's why Israel was to eliminate the Canaanites and the otherites. And so it is true that some of these places that are named were very strategic, a place that was sort of the crossroads of trade, places that had great fortresses, but that's not really the main concern. The main concern is that they not lead their presence in the land in an ongoing way, not lead to spiritual compromise on the part of Israel. But they did face a great challenge. That is, the forces of Manasseh did, for we're told the Canaanites were determined to dwell in the land. And so the forces of Manasseh have their command. They know from the Lord that they're supposed to take the land. They can expect the Lord to be with them. And yet, in some way, they have a failure of nerve. And they do not prevail over them. And therefore, the Canaanites continued to dwell in those places in the land. Verse 28, and it came to pass when Israel was strong that they put the Canaanites under tribute, but did not completely drive them out. And this is where it's really hard to give any kind of an excuse to the tribe of Manasseh. We might have some sympathy with going up against a greater military force than they themselves had. But you see, later, when they had enough strength to expel the Canaanites, they didn't do it. Rather, they put them under tribute, which meant they let them dwell in the land. They put them under forced labor. They turned them into their servants and slaves. And that covenant failure would prove to be spiritually perilous. So even when they gained the strength to do what the Lord had told them to do, they didn't. They thought of themselves. They thought how wonderful it would be to have these people serving them, and that's what they did. Well, now we turn to the other half of the house of Joseph in verse 29. Nor did Ephraim drive out the Canaanites who dwelt in Gezer, so the Canaanites dwelt in Gezer among them. Now, in the case of Ephraim, we only get bad news. It's a very short report. Because they failed to drive the Canaanites out of Gezer, the Canaanites dwelt in Gezer among them. And so this staging ground for spiritual compromise and apostasy was just what Yahweh had warned against. Do not let the people dwell in the land. You will do so to your own spiritual peril. And yet Ephraim did not drive them out. So this brings us to the next point in our outline, C under 2, and that is the other tribes in verses 30 through 36. And I'm just going to read these verses together, and I want you to listen to the words and phrases that are repeated. Beginning in verse 30, nor did Zebulun drive out the inhabitants of Kitron or the inhabitants of Nahalal, so the Canaanites dwelt among them and were put under tribute. Nor did Asher drive out the inhabitants of Akko or the inhabitants of Sidon or of Halab, Akzib, Helba, Afik, or Rehob. So the Asherites dwelt among the Canaanites, the inhabitants of the land, for they did not drive them out. Nor did Naphtali drive out the inhabitants of Beth Shemesh or the inhabitants of Beth Anath, but they dwelt among the Canaanites, the inhabitants of the land. Nevertheless, the inhabitants of Beth Shemesh and Beth Anath were put under tribute to them. And the Amorites forced the children of Dan into the mountains, for they would not allow them to come down to the valley. And the Amorites were determined to dwell in Mount Heres, in Ajalon, and in Sha'albim. Yet when the strength of the house of Joseph became greater, they were put under tribute. Now the boundary of the Amorites was from the ascent of Akrabim, from Selah, and upward. So what do we hear over and over? Nor did Zebulun drive out the inhabitants. The inhabitants. Nor did Asher drive out the inhabitants. Nor did Naphtali drive out the inhabitants of one place or the inhabitants of another. They're told the Canaanites dwelt among them. The Asherites dwelt among the Canaanites. They dwelt among the Canaanites. And then we're told in two cases that they were put under tribute. And again, if they're putting them under tribute, that means they have got the strength over them at that point. They could force them out. And instead, in disobedience to the Lord, they keep among them and use them as servants. And we're not going to look at all of those individual places and their significance, but I do want to look at what we read in verses 34 and 35. And the Amorites forced the children of Dan into the mountains, for they would not allow them to come down to the valley. And the Amorites were determined to dwell in Mount Heres, in Aijalon, and in Shaalbim. Yet when the strength of the house of Joseph became greater, they were put under tribute. And one commentator points out sort of the sad significance of this. In verse 35, it is sad to note that the Canaanites, the Amorites, persisted in the region of Aijalon and Mount Heres, which means Mountain of the Sun. For this is where Joshua had defeated them, and the sun had been made to stand still. Indeed, it is where Joshua was buried. What an appalling situation that the Canaanites should recapture these great memorial sites. What a sad contrast with the former victory at this location. And so by the time we get to the end of chapter 1, we are wholly in sort of negative territory, and that is what's going to set us up for what we see next time when Yahweh himself gives an evaluation of the tribes. But I want to close today with some words from Dr. Ralph Davis, who I alluded to earlier, a commentator who's written a really good commentary. He has one on Joshua and also one on Judges. And he points out, though our writer repeatedly accuses Israel of covenant failure, she did not dispossess or she did not drive out, he nevertheless describes her military success. This point is frequently missed. Four times he tells us that the Canaanites or Amorites became subject to forced labor. What does this mean? It means that if once Israel's tribes were not strong enough to expel the local residents, the time came when Israel grew strong and could dominate the Canaanite population. But instead of expelling, instead of driving out these enclaves, which according to the biblical text, Israel was now perfectly able to do, she put them to forced labor in violation of Yahweh's commands. The picture Judges 1 gives us is of an Israel in substantial control of Canaan, a people clearly successful, though certainly disobedient. Pragmatic success and spiritual failure, a strange but possible combination. So Israel is dominant, if not obedient. She enjoys superiority, even if she does not maintain fidelity. And the text carries its admonition for God's people in any age. For one thing, it tells us that it is possible for the believer's life to display marks of success and yet be a failure in the eyes of God. Christian success, whether personal or in the form of a glossy evangelical enterprise, is not necessarily the same as pleasing God. And, we're told in Acts that we're given these accounts to be examples for us. We're to learn from the lessons from the Old Testament, and that's both positive lessons and negative lessons. And again, next time, we're going to hear from the Lord himself and his evaluation as we complete this long introduction to the book of Judges.